podcast is part of the Sports Social Podcast Network.
Hello and welcome to the Wisden Cricket Weekly podcast. It's been an extremely hectic week in English cricket. England have dropped their two greatest ever wicket takers in Test cricket. Heads have rolled at the ECB. England have lost another Ashes series without winning a single match. And there was even a World Cup final defeat snuck in there as well. We'll be talking about all that, Justin Langer's resignation as Australia coach, and much, much more over the next hour or so. I'm Yaz Rana, and with me today is the magazine editor of Wisden Cricket Monthly, Joe Harmon, the editor-in-chief of Wisden Cricket Monthly, Phil Walker, and the managing editor of Wisden.com, Ben Gardner. Firstly, let's head to Mark Butcher to hear what he thinks about England dropping Stuart Broad and James Anderson for the tour to the Caribbean next month. But we've had about a million questions on this since the news was broken last night. Can you see the logic behind what England have done in leaving out both James Anderson and Stuart Broad?
No. I can't. I could certainly see an argument for giving Jimmy the tour off. I think with Stuart, only because his performances have been fantastic. Unimpeachable for the last at least a year, but probably longer than that. But also from the point of view of what he quite rightly said about trying to win what's right in front of you, or giving yourself at least the best chance of trying to win the games that are right in front of you. I find it quite bizarre that he didn't make the trip. And also, you know, the replacement for him, you know, Matt Fisher is an interesting one. I was a bit blindsided by that. But he has certain attributes that might be of use in Test match cricket. He's tall, he kind of hits the pitch really hard, gets in close to the stumps. You know, he's got a sort of a McGrath-like action through the crease. Not a comparison, but it's just, you know, it's a type of the way that he operates. And so he could be somebody that whose game, whilst it hasn't been sort of massively eye-catching at first-class level, could translate into something that will do good things in Test match cricket. But in terms of taking a team which looks on paper as though it can but win in the West Indies, and let's face it, this team needs a win, right? It needs maybe one Test match win, but it needs a series win. You're kind of thinking to yourself, well, I'd quite like to have had Stuart up my sleeve to play in all three Test matches and to lead what is going to be a relatively inexperienced attack, particularly given that you know, England's sort of most senior bowler in all of that is Chris Wokes, and Wokes was anonymous in the Ashes. You know, I'll hold my hands up. I thought that he turned a corner with the Kookaburra and all that. But he, although unlucky as the tour went a little bit further on, kind of just didn't dispel any of the issues that people have had with his performances overseas. And that's a worry. He's now our main guy on the trip.
I guess there are quite a few strands there that are quite hard to get your head around. One, I guess, is that it's exciting to see a couple of new faces in there, but England are likely to go into that first test with an attack of Ollie Robinson and Mark Woods, Chris Wokes and Jack Leach, which is the attack they start the Ashes with. And we can understand why they're backing Ollie Robinson and Mark Wood, both have been very good with the ball in the last year or so. But so one, these new guys might not even play. And then two, I guess, this is an extremely big call to make under an interim head coach. Surely the new head coach wants to be the person who wants to make that decision. A new head coach might come in, look at the squad and say, there aren't many experienced Test match players who are used to being part of a winning side. I want every Test match I can get out of Anderson and Broad. That decision has partly been taken away from him because Strauss, Root, Stokes are all still going to be part of the England setup in one way or another when the new coach comes in. And that decision's slightly been taken out of the new coach's hands.
Well, I mean, you know, the door's been left open by the comments that Andrew Strauss makes. And, you know, I hesitate to kind of to have a go at Strauss's logic because he's been here before as a captain and as a sort of a director of cricket. And both times he's made sort of big calls over big senior players, and both times he's been vindicated in the end. What I would say is the position with both James and Stewart is very different from any that he's made before, because Broad and Anderson are still England's outstanding bowlers in England's lineup. If you take Mark Wood out of the equation, and Mark Wood will play, you know, Mark Wood is very much in that sort of top three. And as I said before, I can understand the logic of giving Jimmy the trip off. I mean, you know, West Indies pitches, you know, that kind of hit the pitch hard type thing might, you know, he'd be able to cope with it. It's no problem. But it just seems like unnecessarily mileage on his clock. Whereas for Stewart, he's exactly the sort of, but you remember the furore last time he got left out down there for Sam Curran.
Mm.
You know, Stewart is exactly the type of bowler that you want and need on West Indian surfaces. And so the case for him being there and perhaps not starting off in the summer or, you know, being called time on in the summer if it didn't go well in the West Indies was compelling to have him go to the West Indies to prove that he still has the desire. Not that I don't think he needs to prove it, but just to prove to everybody else that, listen, I'm a test match cricketer. I'm one of the best there has ever been. And I damn well deserve to be wearing the shirt. So look, I mean, that will rumble on. You know, things go badly. You lose a toss and get spanked all over the place in the first one. Then Anderson and Broad, as it was in Brisbane, is going to be the worst decision in the world. I go back to this. I see, I get that. Stewart, not.
I think there'll be a couple of newspaper columns this weekend that are worth keeping an eye on from Messrs. Anderson and Broad. Just trying to get my head around why. Root and Stokes, why they might have been part of that call. I guess there were some clues there when Anderson had a niggle at Brisbane, Broad didn't play, which was a surprise, especially given the conditions there. Anderson and Broad were criticised for bowling a little bit too short. At one point, I think it was during the Adelaide test, when Stokes was captain for one test match in the 2020 summer, Stuart Broad, who was arguably England's bowler of 2019, was left out of that one test. So you kind of get the impression that if they don't want the two of them in the side, they don't really want them on the bench either. And it's not, we've kind of had hints that it all has not been well behind the scenes, not as well as it could have been or might have been in the past.
There is that whole thing whereby, and this is, you know, another strand to the discussion, whereby a new broom, and you know, it's not a new broom. Joe Root is the most capped captain that England has ever had. Trying to kind of their marker upon a team full of new guys is much easier than doing it with guys who have been around forever. And every organisation goes through that, you know, whereby the old guard, whilst still performing and whilst aren't perhaps allowing you to move things forward in the way that you want to as a management group. And again, that's something that I get and I understand. However, it's been the same with other great players down the line. How much sort of interim pain are you willing to take, and how much are you willing to risk the fact that your job might end up being on the line if results continue to go on a downward curve in order to kind of make this point? And isn't the art of management being able to assimilate all of these people, the old guys, the new guys, and try to bring them together as a team? And if what they're saying is that Anderson and Broad's attitude or their belligerence or grumpiness or whatever around the group is something that's preventing the team from moving forward, then I would suggest that you know, the batters who haven't managed to get England past 300 in the last 10 innings might wear cotton wool in the dressing room when they come in, so they can't hear them speaking, because what they're doing on the field is not a problem. The whole thing about, but you know, the short length in Adelaide and all those types of things, you know, the bowlers will turn around to you and say, listen, if the ball's not swinging, we're not pitching it up. And then as soon as it, you know, and then when the ball moves, we'll get it up a little bit further. It's kind of, you know, that's a natural tendency. You defend when things are not in your favour, and you attack when they are. And these two blokes have got nearly 1,200 test match wickets between them. I think they know. I think they understand and can figure it out. These are not a couple of newbies that have no idea. Look, it'll run and run. The Leach thing you mentioned before is very interesting. That I don't get at all.
What, that he's been included?
I don't understand. I do not understand, because over the course of the run up to the Ashes, they proved that they had no confidence in picking him whatsoever, right? That did everything in their power not to include him in teams against New Zealand and India up until the very end. then they play him in Brisbane, which I don't have an issue with him playing him in Brisbane. We just shouldn't have batted first, you know. Crikey. But having had no cricket, they kind of, you know, he got spanked in Brisbane. And then leave him out on the one pitch where you must play the specialist spinner in Adelaide. Joe Root has shown no sign whatsoever of having any confidence in this guy. And to me, after getting the mauling that he got in Australia, for him now to be the sort of the number one guy as a spinner again just doesn't make any sense.
Mm.
You know, whether or not he is the best bowler that we've got in the country, which I'm starting to doubt very much. But you know, at what point do you just say, you know what, we're flogging the wrong horse here, and we try to bring somebody else in? I mean, if they've gone with Matt Parkinson, I'd have taken his brother as well. They've got, you know, leg spinner and left arm spinner in Leach and Parkinson. I'd have taken Callum Parkinson. Said you go.
Mm.
I know, you know, Antigua can turn. There might well be cause for the spinners to have some joy out there. But you know, put it this way: if he doesn't play all three Test matches and doesn't have a good time, then that really should be it. Because I don't see how you move forward from where that relationship is.
I hear what you're saying, but I'd argue that it's not been clear who among English spinners Root really does back, because Don Best, you know, he was taken out of the attack in India after bowling badly, and we've basically not seen him since. Understandably, I guess Matt Parkinson's been part of quite a few tours without ever getting a game. So you'd have thought England have seen a lot of Matt Parkinson in the nets, and for one reason or another, despite his excellent first class record, they've not picked him yet. So I kind of like, what's changed in Australia? He didn't play in the England Lions game. What's changed since then?
He is on the trip. I mean, the thing you're talking about there is not the spinner then per se. It's the captain.
Mm.
And that's another strand of conversation entirely, isn't it?
Mm.
You know, that is part of the issue with England and their lack of trust in, or their lack of improvement with the spin bowlers that have been picked, down to a captain who is naturally suspicious of them or doesn't handle them particularly well. I think there's plenty of evidence to show that potentially is a large slice of it, which is again why I'm slightly confused, because it would have made sense to me if Joe Root, who has stayed on as captain, who is his captain as part of the selection panel along with Taylor and everybody else, had said, you know what, it just isn't working out with myself and Jack Leach. Let's look somewhere else. What we're asking for is a change in that relationship. And if that doesn't happen, then, you know, who's going? Well, it ain't going to be Joe Root, is it? he has proven himself to be unsackable. But, you know, he's sort of come through it relatively unscathed with a remit to kind of go again and rebuild again. And so at the moment, he's not going anywhere.
Cheers for your time, Butch. Talk to you next week.
Okay.
The eight players who were part of the Ashes squad haven't made the cut. James Anderson, Stuart Broad, most famously, but also Don Best, Sam Billings, Roy Burns, Josh Butler, Haseeb Ameed, and Dowd Malan. Joe, they're England's two greatest wicket takers. Broad was England's leading wicket taker in 2019 and 2020. Anderson in 2021. Since Anderson was Broad's age, which is 35, he's taken 117 wickets at 21. Andrew Strauss said that this isn't necessarily the end for them and the door isn't completely closed, but can you make some sense of what's gone on?
I think it's fair to say we were all taken aback when the news came through yesterday. And the more I've thought about it since, the less the decision makes sense to me. I think the caveat is we don't know what's been going on in the dressing room. There are sort of vague echoes of 13-14 with Peterson, that there is a kind of, like, Michael Vaughan's column in the Telegraph this morning talking about culture, which generally only comes up when teams are losing. I think Root obviously has had a part of this decision. We can't think that Strauss has done it independently with Collingwood and Taylor. And if Root doesn't think he can manage the team the way he wants with Broad and Anderson, then that creates doubt about his qualities as a captain as much as anything else. And I was thinking, if we had a fit and firing Jofra Archer, if Ollie Stone had been able to build on that really impressive test match in India last year, and we had the kind of wealth of seam options that we hoped we would at this stage, then maybe I could get on board with this. But when you've got Matthew Fisher coming into the squad, who is a very talented bowler and has been talked about for a long time, you just have to say it's a punt. It's nothing more than a punt. He's never taken more than 20 first-class wickets in a season. He's only taken 2 first-class fifers. He debuted, albeit very young, in, I think, 2016, maybe 2015. So they've obviously identified someone there and they think there's potential, but to throw him into a Caribbean tour where England have struggled to win and drop Broad and Anderson, yeah, as I say, it's a punt and nothing more than that. And, you know, it might come off, but I can't help but feel that England have made their life a lot more difficult in an already very difficult situation.
Phil, can you make some sense of what's going on? Could you kind of see where Root and Co. are coming from?
Yeah, I mean, we'd love to know how much influence or how much overall control Root has had over the picking of this squad. And how much the big boss, Sir Andrew, has decided upon this squad. Because if it's the latter, then that's thrown quite a few people off kilter, isn't it? Because people were baying for Strauss to come in as Mr. Common Sense with that kind of assumed authority that he's garnered over the years. If this is largely Strauss's call, then that's an interesting element to it as well. Clearly, something has been burbling away for a while now between the power couple of Root and Stokes and the other power couple of Anderson and Broad. If you're picking a squad purely on quality and record, then clearly the two of them go. They're the first two bowlers that you put down on the sheet, without a shadow of a doubt. For me, this looks like a two-pronged decision based on the one hand, clearly their age, in the sense that cycle has come to a rather ignominious finish in Australia. And two, the fact that they are so influential and so powerful in that dressing room, and Root, who is not particularly domineering himself, has had trouble, I think, managing the two of them. And it came to a head in the build-up to Brisbane when famously, infamously, Broad didn't play, which was a peculiar decision at best, and Anderson was deemed to be injured and yet was bowling full tilt on the morning of the game in the nets. And then throw it forward 2 weeks later and Broad is saying quite pointedly in his latest kind of demonstrable masterclass media interview, well, you know, if the batsman can't get past 140, there's not much we can do. Now, there is a kind of brutal common sense truth to that, but it's also quite a clear challenge to the brains trust at the top of the English Test side. So
also, in between those two things, you had Root after Adelaide, was it, talking about England's bowlers not bowling the line and length that he wanted, which, right, you know, was I mean, it wasn't even veiled criticism. It was criticism of his bowling attack, and people immediately think Broad and Anderson. So yeah, there were signs that
this has been coming.
Yeah, this has been coming.
Was it last summer? No, summer before the COVID summer, when Root wasn't skipper and Stokes took over for that game and dropped Broad straight away, and Broad blamed it on Ed Smith. Not that Ed Smith has ever picked the final 11 ever. It was Stokes who pointedly took him aside and said, "You're not playing in this game." And then it led to Broad's first great media statement, one of many. So there's clearly been a kind of a fracturing in those two very, very powerful power positions at the top of the English game. And Strauss, my guess is that Strauss has come in and said, okay, he's dealt with some challenges in his own leadership role with the England side in the past. Rather than let that fester, perhaps he said, we need a break for now. My guess, for what it's worth, is that both Anderson and Broad will play Test cricket again. That's
really
my guess.
Yeah. Do you think they'll play in the summer?
I absolutely think that's more than likely. I think, as I've been saying for months and months and months, April is year dot for this England Test side. And so these West Indies games are very important, for sure. But if there needs to be a kind of a bit of breathing space after the horrors of what happened in Australia, and if there needs to be a slow reset that can only start really taking place, hastening from the start of next season onwards, then so be it. But I don't think any new coach coming in will be putting a big red line through those two names.
No, on balance, I probably just about agree with you on that, that Broaden Anderson will play again, but I don't think we can say that of any confidence. If they do win in the Caribbean and a new coach comes in, to then go back to Broaden Anderson would seem like a backward step, wouldn't it? I think that would make it quite difficult for a new coach to go back there again.
Yeah, does it give them a bit of a clean slate though? Like if a new coach comes in and the future of Broaden Anderson's obviously been a hot topic for like, you know, a long period of time, how we're going to transition, and this is obviously not the ideal way to do this and how they planned it. But if a new coach comes in, they either bring them back in and then they're kind of, you know, they get an instant kind of good news story and that's like a quite a populist move basically. And they might also think it's the right move, which it, you know, probably would be. But they get to just kind of continue a decision made by a previous regime rather than having to come in and do that thing as like an instant sort of like be very ballsy for a new coach to do, and they might, you know, might not feel you have the power to do that instantly as a new coach. I think the other thing, so Root, he talks about having a reset during the Ashes, isn't he? Similar to the one after the 2015 World Cup. And I suppose Broad and Anderson were two of the biggest names not to be in that side properly moving forward. Obviously, Broad played a couple of games in South Africa after that World Cup, but basically they were out of it. And it was Strauss also who kind of oversaw that regeneration of that side. So I can kind of see how England got there, and I think with hindsight you can see the signs that were there. But I think maybe me and you, Phil, just see the importance of these West Indies games quite differently. Like, I think England just need to start winning some games of cricket basically, and they don't have the quality of player to not pick their best side available to do that. And this is a, you know,
I'm just trying to understand it from their point of view.
Yeah, yeah.
I was saying one other thing is that Anderson and Broad haven't been both in England's best side for a little bit now. I think England see Robinson and Wood as kind of nailed down. But then my next question would be, how bad is their influence really if it affects their bat? England couldn't score runs. Does that actually, they might be a bit annoying. They might not be.
And they'll be bowlers on the side.
And what Joe says about Joe Root's captaincy. Now, you know, if I think as Ponting said a few days ago, if a captain can't deal with his fast bowlers, then he's not really doing his job properly. And it does throw a lot of shade, I think, on Root's leadership if these two figures, these two complete legends of the game, are deemed to be more, let's call it as it is, more trouble than they're worth if they're not in the side.
And it's also quite interesting because we've heard a lot coming from previous England assistant coaches, etc., the last few months, who've said that the environment's perhaps been too cosy. And what's the first thing they've done? They've got the two players, senior players, who've been there, done it, won everything there is to win in Test cricket, getting rid of them because they're a bit too challenging. I mean, I can't really see what the other explanation for this is, because you both, as we're all saying, those two are 100% in your best squad if you're picking it just on merit.
I think Strauss's role here is fascinating as well, because he is in this caretaker role. So on the one hand, you know, it's a punchy move for a caretaker to make. On the other, he's kind of got a free hit. He can do this and then sort of disappear. It's quite convenient for Root in that sense. If he doesn't really want Anderson and Broad to be part of the future of the England Test team, Root is obviously taking some of the flack here, but it's sort of on Strauss. Strauss is the one out there today justifying it to the press. It's quite a kind of convenient way of doing it if it goes to plan. And
Strauss,
if it doesn't go to plan, then
well,
it's not. Then it wasn't necessarily Root's call.
Strauss has done this before as well, hasn't he? When he's been in this kind of management position, he's put himself in the firing line to try and deflect any grief from the skipper himself. He did it with Cook? I think that he was kind of shielding many years ago, and I think that is quite an interesting approach here. And it remains, as we say, a bit of a mystery whose decision ultimately this is. You can't help thinking that this has come mainly from Root and been legitimised by the boss, by Strauss, by Sir Andrew, who's deemed this to be the way to go, and so we have to try and get our heads around it. It's baffling, but there is a kind of kernel of common sense, kernel of logic behind it as well. I just want to go back briefly to the West Indies thing. These are important Test matches. Of course they are important Test matches. It's just interesting that I can't remember after which Test match it was, but I was obviously riled up, sleep deprived, angry, and I was saying, start again, you know, rip it up, tongue in cheek.
A lot of them.
And then when we came to do
when
we came to do our squads a couple of weeks ago, around in this setup, and I picked mine, and there were one or two funky ideas in there, nowhere near as many as actually are in there.
Yeah.
And so And again, that notion, well, you know, they've dropped the bowlers because the batsmen have failed. They've dropped the batsmen as well, right, folks? You know, they've dropped both their openers. They've dropped the number three and they've dropped the number 6-7 keeper bat as well. So four of their top seven are gone.
Yeah.
And probably for quite a while gone. We'll come to that in a minute.
Yeah, well, just on the Strauss fronting up thing, it's a refreshing change as well, given how for so long we've had basically Joe Root having to be the front man for the ECB's kind of mistakes or dodgy decisions. Like, he was the one who had to come and explain a lot of the rest and rotation stuff when it wasn't really his decision to do so. He was the one, and Tom Harrison was kind of nowhere to be seen for quite a long time. I mean, he still isn't that prominent, but at least we have a temporary managing director who is putting himself forward and taking some of those questions.
And Giles too, who he did do press, but I never felt like he took ownership of anything that was going on, which left others looking for fingers to point elsewhere. And yeah, I absolutely agree. I think it's really refreshing. And Root will, I imagine, will be mightily relieved that he's got someone kind of befitting the role alongside him, even if it is just temporary.
Yeah, ESPN Cricket Info's Matt Roller tweeted that the selection panel all made their test debuts after James Anderson did. So Strauss, Collingwood, James Taylor, Root.
If this is it, by the way, I mean, what a grim way to go, to just be the subject of, you know, various Twitter scandals and, you know, a podcast the morning after, and this is the way two of the all-timers go. If this is it, if the door truly has been closed now, you know, they say, you know, all great political careers end in failure. Well, it feels a little bit like that. And while, sure, roll the cliches out, there's no place for sentiment and all the rest of it, it does feel jarring, to say the least, that we might have suddenly seen two of the greatest, and arguably the greatest in Anderson, never play again. If that is the case, then I'll just remember that spell, that Anderson spell over the winter, six overs, one for one in six overs, and it could have been 3-1. And he just
It's a year to the day since phenomenal. He got Shubman Gill and Rahane bowled at Chennai to win that test match.
Yeah, right.
At least their last act together would have been quite sweet, you know, saving that test match, the one sort of ray of light in that winter with their sweet conversation in the middle saying, don't worry, mate, I've done this before.
And also,
wouldn't have known then that you might not do it again. But
and also that there's been very little drop-off. I mean, no drop-off in the case of Anderson, a little bit of a drop-off in Broad. If this is to be the end, they basically went out bowling as well as they ever did, which not many bowlers can say that.
Yeah, kind of like trying to predict what happens. I can see England winning the West Indies without playing that well. Like, I know we always say West Indies is a difficult place to go, and it is, and England's record there is awful. But West Indies is a bad West Indies side. Their batting lineup is even worse than England's. They've really, really struggled recently, and I can see a not great England side actually winning that series 2-1.
But England have failed to beat not very good West Indies side.
I think this is a worse batting lineup, but
you know, Colin Graves described them as media before, and we give them they raise their game when they play England.
Yeah, that's true.
And that's what they do. And as much as the batting lineup isn't good, they do have a very good bowling attack, and it is a bowling attack that could easily run through England a couple of times. Like, it's no given that England will win this, and if they lose it, then really, I mean, like, as much as Joe Root's by rights his position of captain should be untenable now, if there was any viable alternatives, like, even if there's no viable alternatives for England losing the West Indies against a West Indies side about whom all those things you say are correct, then how can he carry on after that?
It's a brave call. Go on, Joe.
Well, I said to Phil yesterday, if England do lose in the West Indies, we could have the weirdest England captain that we've had in my living memory. Because we all sat around here and said, well, if it's not Root, then it's probably Broad, even though that's not a perfect solution.
Might be Burns if he gets a few runs in the West Indies and he's not there.
Or it's James Vince comes as his specialist captain. It could get quite weird over the next couple of months.
But Butler had his hat in the ring. But obviously won't ever be in the ring again.
So yeah, Root's just dropped all the potential captaincy successes. Pretty clever.
Yeah. Nice. Very Johnsonian.
Yeah. Well, one thing that's quite interesting, I think that Strauss has said, well, it's been reported that Strauss wants to separate the coaching job between White Ball and Red Ball. I wonder if that's...
Sorry, has he said that?
I think it's been reported that he wants to, yeah. I think it's quite interesting from the squad, if that's kind of what he wants to do, the playing staff as well. I mean, with the exception of Stokes and Wood... Really, and no one on that team gets in the England T20 side, and Besto, sorry. And, you know, Milan and Butler's, their recent test record, they're not egregious. You could
It's your new word, isn't it? You use that every week. It's
do
really
I?
Good, yeah.
Okay, get rid of that then. We were talking before the squad was announced that England could have ended up picking a squad that wasn't actually that dissimilar to the Ashes, and they could have just about justified it. I mean, we pretty much did that when we picked our squad a couple of weeks ago. So I wonder if that's something that Strauss is trying to implement as well.
Well, I mean, look, there's cold, hard logic to that, isn't there? And we've spoken about the split coaches role for a long time now, and it's obviously staring us in the face.
Yeah, we could talk about this squad for hours, but one thing I want to talk about briefly is the presence of two pod favourites in the squad, Matt Parkinson and Dan Lawrence. I think it's interesting just because of how low in the pecking order they seem quite recently. England are only taking 16 people to West Indies, which is a smallish squad anyway, particularly so during COVID times. Dan Lawrence didn't get a game in Australia when the batters weren't getting any runs. Matt Parkinson didn't even get a bowl for the England Lions when they played Australia A. So I guess that's quite interesting that those two guys are there in a reasonably small squad.
Yeah, it is. I mean, England have to have a backup spinner, I suppose. And it could be that Matt Parkinson is still that. And, you know, it was actually always been quite close between Bess and Parkinson over who plays. I mean, what, back at the start of 2020, Parkinson was in the squad over Bess. And then Bess comes in when Leach is out and then out bowls me the warmest. So it's actually always been quite tight between those two. So this could be another tight call. And maybe they do want to mix up who they take to sit on the bench, basically, in case Leach rolls an ankle, even though England don't mind not playing a spinner anyway. But there is the possibility that, you know, I mean, and England haven't trusted Leach overall over this whole stretch of Silverwood's time. And you wonder, like, Silverwood, you mentioned this before we started recording, Phil, that Silverwood's whole thing has been attritional cricket, you know, bat big, bowl dry. Alleghi doesn't really fit into that. But Root has, in the past, I mean, as much he doesn't handle his, there's been question about how he handles his spinners. Adil Rashid was a key part of the high point, really, of the Joe Root era, which was that win against India at home and then the win against Sri Lanka away. And in that Sri Lanka series especially, Root was a captain who almost captained like he batted, in that he would find ways to sort of problem solve a situation in front of him and adapt his game a little bit and that sort of thing. And that's what bowlers, they all kind of dovetailed. He had different bowlers for different times, and that's what worked. And that's where Alleghi really comes in. They're not in the game the whole time, but they do allow you to get something out of nothing to throw the ball to when nothing else is going on. And it gives you an attack with lots of different angles.
I guess the problem with it, and you're absolutely right, and it's a good point on Rashid, he had the protection of being alongside Moeen and probably in Moeen's slipstream. Obviously, if Parkinson were to come into the side, then more than likely he'd come in as the sole spinner. It's hard to see them playing both, although you never know in the West Indies. But that then becomes an immensely challenging role for, you know, what still remains a rookie leg spinner who's not played a massive amount of red ball cricket.
Although Root's improvements as a test bowler might help Parkinson's case in that regard. Root can get through quite a few overs these days.
So he's skipper, revolutionary, batting three, kingmaker,
batting three,
and
yeah,
premier off spinner as well. Good luck to him.
Yeah. We've got, it's pretty much exactly a month till the test series starts. So there's plenty of time to talk about some of the other names in that group. But as I mentioned at the top, loads of stuff's happened at the ECB in the last week. All change, really. Chris Silverwood has left his coach. Normally we'd start a show with that news, but Chris Silverwood has left his role as England's men's head coach. Ashley Giles is no longer the director of men's cricket, and Graham Thorpe is no longer part of the England coaching setup either. Paul Collingwood has been named as the interim head coach. And we've had a few questions on coaching. Stu asks, given the recent exodus of the more laid-back style of the Silverwood era within the England camp, juxtaposed to the exit of Justin Langer from the Australia team for, in essence, the stylistic opposite, what do you believe is the right track England need right now to go down with the picking of their new full-time coaching staff? Discuss. Phil, you wrote a piece on this on wisdom.com. You basically called for a gnarly old bastard to be England's next head coach.
Yeah, there was a hole on the website on a Friday afternoon, so I thought I'd fill it. Yeah, look, it's been quite a tricky time for coaches. Obviously, we'll come to the Justin Langer saga in due course, but it seems you're either kind of pigeonholed as too intense by half, and therefore kind of threatening and suffocating the creativity of the individuals and the expressiveness of the individuals, or you're too soft and avuncular and you let them get away with too much. What I really want to see, what I think this particular England side has been crying out for, is a really technically minded batting specialist head coach.
Anyone you've spoken to recently that fits the bill?
It could be him. It could be Kirsten for sure, but it could be somebody else. It could be Ricky Ponting. It could be Justin Langer. It could be any number of names. But I think what's been lacking has been a little bit of technical clarity, a lot of technical clarity with a lot of players. And it seems that every batter, bar Root, and a push Stokes, but even that, jury's sort of out, really, have gone backwards. Every single one that's come into the England setup has gone backwards. Now, sure, they had a head batting coach in Graham Thorpe, who sort of smoked his way out of that setup as well. But much of it comes from the head coach as well, I think. And Silverwood, for all his qualities, and he was very popular among the players, and he worked incredibly hard, selflessly, in a job that you wouldn't wish on your worst enemy at certain times when you're living out of a suitcase for 300 days a year. But he was not, and never will be, a batting specialist. And this is the glaring problem that we have with young players who are coming in with an overload of information, and it creates a kind of paralysis, I think, of the mind. And you see it with certain players. We don't need to name them because we all know who they are and they know themselves. Duncan Fletcher's star continues to rise. And the Duncan Fletcher era is almost kind of mythic. And what he did, famously, is make good players better. And what we've seen, unfortunately, with the coaching setup for the last 2 years around the England side is that good players, or possibly good players, or possibly mediocre players, have got worse. And that, to me, rather than the specific personnel, it's what they bring, what kind of expertise they bring, that's important to me.
Yeah, however good you think they are, the got worse bit is undeniable. Joe, we had another question on coaches. Freddie asked, firstly, I love the podcast and listen to it religiously. It balances news and analysis superbly and is always balanced and fair. Well, not sure about that. My question is, who would be your top three picks for the new England head coach? And if you believe that the role should be split between Test and Whiteball, who are your top three picks for that? So six coaches, please, Joe. Just one or two names that stand out for you.
Well, first up, I do think it should be split coaches. I think we've kind of all maybe got to that point over recent months, which is quite interesting in itself because that potentially determines the types of personality you want in those roles. So, for instance, it's hard to talk about stuff without moving on to Justin Langer because Nick Hockley, Cricket Australia's CEO, said Australia were evolving to the next phase of a more shared leadership model. Now, read between the lines, Langer's a control freak and wants to do it all. I think you can get to that point without jumping too far. So therefore, is Langer really the sort of character who should be coaching the Test side when he won't be doing the whole lot, when there is likely to be someone doing the white ball side? I would say no.
I'll be shocked if it's Langer. I'll be amazed.
There's sort of I was thinking the other day, it's Mourinho to Spurs vibes, and that there's like about 5%
that never happened,
thinking like maybe it's genius, but the overwhelming feeling is that's going to be a disaster.
It would be really funny.
It would be
funny, but I just think it's implausible. Look, you can have my badge if Langer ends up as England's next full-time coach.
But anyway, sorry, to come around back to the question. So on that basis, I would, my Test coach would be someone who just wants to do the Test team, hasn't got an interest in doing the whole lot, which could be Gary Kirsten or it could be Ricky Ponting. Those would be the two outstanding candidates. Kirsten clearly wants the job, as he's told Phil and as Phil has relayed to the world. And
that backfired as well, apparently.
I'd say you want a job now.
Can't do anything these days.
I did think it wasn't necessarily the smartest way of going. From him, not you. You're just doing your job, Phil.
Can I just clarify that situation, by the way? Because I know that he did get some grief for that. And I know that he spoke to somebody else as well, so it wasn't just via me. But it was just after Christmas and he was on vacation with his family and he was fishing and we'd had a chat a few weeks beforehand about this, that and the other. And I said, do you fancy a chat? And he said, yeah, okay. So we had a chat. And naturally, we spoke about English cricket as well as speaking about other stuff. And he just said, yeah, I'd be a part of the conversation if the conversation ever came round. And then it ends up on Sky and then it becomes Kirsten gunning for Silverwood while Silverwood's poorly with COVID and so on and so on. It wasn't that set up. Yeah. And if I did end up setting him up like that, then I didn't kind of mean to, really. So
my reaction
He certainly wasn't gunning. He certainly wasn't seeking out the media.
He had also
to try
given
and a, position himself.
He had also given another interview to The Independent, though, hadn't he?
Sure. I'm just saying from my
it
my
wasn't
perspective,
it wasn't yeah all. Sure, but it wasn't coaxed out of him exactly. Like he was he.
But
he
again,
knew what he was
saying. He didn't say I want the England job either. He just said, you know, I've been a part of the conversations before and I'd be a part of the conversations again.
The other thing is, sorry, just he also just answers questions directly, which I think you should. Like, it was weird the amount of
the
journalists
job.
Were like, oh, you can't be doing that. You should and similar with Pat Cummins, actually, people were saying Pat Cummins should have backed Justin Langer. Like, if he doesn't want Justin Langer to remain as head coach, why should he be backing Justin Langer? So I remember with Kirsten when he was head coach of Welsh Fire in the 100, and he just sort of accidentally broke that Bairstow had been recalled to the test team because he was like doing a thing. He was like, yeah, and we've heard that Bairstow's getting a test call up, so got to deal with that as well. And everyone's like, oh my God. And it's like, because he's just been asked a question about
just
the players
he's
got.
He's
and yeah, he gets asked questions, he answers them. And that is surely what we should all be hoping we can do.
That's what
sensibly.
The ECB fear more than anything. Yeah. Right? So that's probably why he's not going to get the gig. Should I do my rest of my coaches?
Yes, go for it.
And then White Ball, my dream pick would be Jai Wardner. I think that would be great. I mean, imagine Ponting and Jai Wardner as I don't know if they've got the cash for this, but anyway.
That's the thing as
I'll chip in. Yeah.
And perhaps more realistically, I'd be comfortable with Collingwood doing that job. We don't need to reset the White Ball setup. He's been part of it for a while. He's captained a T20 World Cup winning side. So I think that would be a fair pick as well.
Graham Ford is an interesting option. Massively well respected within the game, batting specialist again. He's coached at international level. His name has kind of been on the margins of the conversations, but he would be an interesting option as a test specialist.
Peterson says he's the best coach he's ever worked under.
Yeah, so that's probably put a line through his name as well.
And keep knocking them off.
Peterson won't do it unless county cricket is completely restructured. So
only counties from the second half of the alphabet, or else you're done. KP.
There'll be a lot of people looking at all the change that's taken place very quickly at the ECB and look at one very senior person who's still there.
Who are you talking about? Yes.
Tom Harrison, the great survivor of English cricket. He's still CEO after 7 years at the helm. And we've talked about the on-field stuff to death, but also cricket had another DCMS hearing this week that wasn't great. And he's overseen the game's long-standing negligence in tackling difficult off-field issues, and I think a lot of people will be wondering when is he going to go. I don't really want to have a long conversation about that, but it does seem just very bizarre. Everyone leaving in a very short period of time, and the guy in charge
is that
is
not
still
exactly
there.
Why he is still there, though?
What? Because so many
because everyone else is going. I mean,
yeah. I mean, there isn't
even a chairman at the moment, is there?
Yeah, it's quite interesting seeing Strauss come in, and he's I know he's only doing the job on an interim basis, but how different he is to Giles, and I think all these kind of jobs. It's very hard to be qualified for them because what other jobs really exist like them? I mean, Tom Harrison, by all accounts, is a very decent guy, but he worked in the commercial department for the ECB in his 30s and then worked in selling sports rights, and now he's the CEO of English cricket. I mean, how do those jobs adequately prepare him for what he's doing now?
Yeah, sure.
And same with Giles. And like Giles seems like, again, very good guy who's done a lot of good in English cricket off the field as well as on it. What prepares you for that job, to making those difficult decisions? There's no job in English cricket like it. I think it's very hard to recruit for those two big, big roles.
Yeah, and also if you're talking about decency and being a good clubbable bloke, then you have to also be judged by what you're prepared to take out of the game. And Tom Harrison, as we know, is about to receive a large chunk of 2.1 million quid as a bonus for services rendered for him and another handful of executives at the top of the ECB. This is not just a bunch of journalists sitting around a table kicking off. I've spoken to people at the ECB who are just as appalled by that move from their bosses as people outside of those walls. And if we're looking at his legacy when he does go, and I think that he'll be gone at some point this year, from what we've read and heard, I think that will always be a huge, huge black mark against his time, his tenure in charge.
Mm. Moving on, the Women's Ashes series ended this week as well, with Australia taking all three of the ODIs, which meant they took the overall multi-format series 12-4. The scoreline was very one-sided, but I guess had either the test ruined the first ODI gone the other way, the series could have felt very different at the end. That first ODI was a killer. Australia were restricted to 205 and England fell 27 short. England falling to 10 for 2 and then 37 for 3 in what could have been a reasonably manageable run chase. Ben, a pretty frustrating series for England. The World Cup's around the corner, so they've got that to look forward to. But just seeing some players who do really well against basically everyone else other than Australia, Amy Jones, I guess, being the main example. She averages less than 10 against Australia in both T20i and ODI cricket. She's much better at that as a player. Lauren Renfield-Hill averages less than 15 against Australia in both white ball formats. Danny White averages less than 13 against Australia in ODI cricket. It's quite difficult to beat a side as good as Australia if you've got three of your top six or seven with numbers like that.
Yeah, and I guess that's the thing about how close was this series. Actually, in the end, I think it's a reasonably fair reflection. England did get close in the Test match and close in the first ODI. But the thing about this Australia team is that when you get close and they still are able to keep you at arm's length, basically, they have that kind of that grit as well as being dominant in most games. They now have the know-how that when teams get close, they keep them at bay, basically. And that's especially, it was interesting because this was two, England almost chased, 260 odd in the Test, and then almost chased 200 in the ODI, and both times falling just short. And that kind of shows there's almost a psychological thing, which is very common when England face Australia, and with how good the Australia side are, that makes sense, especially when after England lost the first T20 and then draw the next, or the next two are rained off, and then they have to win the series to retain the Ashes, to regain the Ashes. You're always playing catch up, and massively so. Like, each clutch moment feels even more important, and then that's what you see happening, I guess.
There's a psychological thing at play, isn't there? Clearly, you know, they are so kind of bruised by experiences against Australia over the last few years, and that Test match, just, you know, looking at it now in retrospect, that Test match destroyed them, really. And, you know, for all the plaudits that the game had and received, those 11 players would have walked away from that Test match thinking, right, that was it. That was our moment. That was our moment to do something quite extraordinary. And if they'd done that, then that run chase in the first ODI becomes suddenly a very different proposition. But as it is, it's an embedded belief, or embedded shaky lack of belief, I suppose, you know, that's very hard to shake until you actually start winning a few.
Australia's ODI dominance is just absurd. They've won 29 of their last 30 completed ODIs. And Joe, we were talking about this yesterday. I kind of think, ominously for the rest of the world, I feel the gap between their young players and other teams' young players is actually larger than it possibly is anywhere else. I mean, Darcy Brown's 18, she took a 4 from the first ODI. Annabel Sutherland's 20, she took a 4 from the third ODI. Stella Campbell's another highly rated quick. She's played a couple of internationals recently. She's 19. Phoebe Litchfield's 18, and she was the top run scorer in two of the three games in the Australia A, England A series.
Is she the lefty from the Nets?
Yeah, so there's that viral video of her, I think as a 15 or 16-year-old, just whacking net. And yeah, so she's in the Australia A setup now and probably will play for Australia quite soon. It feels like that's actually the age bracket where they look like they're growing further away from people.
Well, it is. And then also you go slightly older to Tarlene McGrath at 26, who's taken a little while to come through and now looks like an absolute gun player.
Yeah.
Doing a little thing on her for the magazine yesterday. I think she scored 177 runs from, I think it's 133 balls without being dismissed in the last three T20s and being named player of the match of all of them. So we see Perry fading, perhaps, certainly with the ball, and McGrath looks absolutely ready to step in. When I spoke to Lisa Cartney a few months ago, she was really excited about England closing the gap on Australia, but I think she was talking bigger picture stuff, really. Structurally, the number of professionals coming through. And I do think in 3-5 years... England will have closed that gap a bit, even though there is that talent coming through in Australia, because I think there will be in England as well. I think we've only had 100 so far, and that has already had a big impact on the talent pool. But to expect them to come into an Ashes series and just suddenly do it, I think is a bit much. A lot of those young Australians that you talked about, even the really young ones, have played 2 or 3 years of Big Bash, and it makes a huge difference. I think, you know, there's definitely a psychological thing with England playing Australia, but I think Australia are just a better side, really. I thought the T20s were a chance, slightly because they're just a bit more of a lottery, but I think a 3-0 ODI win for Australia was always on the cards, really, because they just don't really lose, ever.
Yeah, and I guess the results England are going to have over the next year or two are a reflection on the previous system that only had 15 to 20 professionals rather than the current system, right? You're not going to, as soon as you increase the number of professionals, that's not going to lead to a change in results in the national side straight away.
Also, you've seen England's first game in the World Cup?
It's Australia.
Australia.
Okay, great.
And then they've got West Indies, then South Africa. So it's one group of eight, top four going through to semi-finals, which I really like as a format, actually. But I mean, I do think England will make the semi-finals, but, you know, if they lose to Australia, South Africa are a really good side. I think they'll make the semis, even without Danny van Niekerk. England might not have it all their own way in that group stage. It's a tricky fixture schedule they've got. So, they need to start quickly and get over the Ashes defeat.
Meanwhile, Sourav Ganguly, boss of the BCCI, was asked about a women's IPL expansion in line with the men's. And he said, basically, we need more people playing the game. This in a country with 1.3 billion people, of which 51% are women. So it's hard to make the case that there's not enough interest. And of course, any overseas player worth their salt would be gravitating to any IPL tournament as well. So look, it's great to see Australia's putting the bar so high. And it promises good things for the women's game in the next 5, 10, 15 years. But getting other teams up to that level, especially when you have head in the sand ignorance such as that, it becomes a long-term challenge, really, for the game.
Yeah, Sara Warris wrote a really good piece on wisdom.com about Ganguly's comments, kind of looking at what Ganguly said over quite a long period of time. So not that long ago, he was on a talk show in India and somebody asked him, what would you say if your daughter wanted to play professional cricket? And he basically laughed it off, saying, I'd say, don't.
Right.
And then kind of she examines kind of how ridiculous his claim is there aren't enough cricketers in India. So, for example, India, I can't remember the number off the top of my head, but they've used quite a big pool of players in quite a short period of time in international cricket. So to expand that to what would be an IPL,
and they have,
you don't actually need that many more players once you factor in the overseas.
And they have 8 team senior competitions they play that just aren't called the women's IPL. They play over 50 over cricket and 20 over cricket, and those are also of a good standard. And I guess the counterpoint is, if Ganguly's right, given he is the person in, like, if he's right and there aren't enough women's professional players or of that standard, and he is the person in charge of cricket in India, why is he not doing every single thing in his power? Because that is a completely dire situation for cricket in the country. And the fact that he sees it as like a sort of a thing that he can just kind of like let slowly increase to the point where there are 70 good players, it just is a damning indictment of his position, I think.
And also, one thing necessarily triggers the other, right? If there's not enough players of quality, then the women's IPL will create that by it being in existence. I mean, it's a nonsense point, really.
It's just a massive open goal, especially when you look at how much demand there is for these competitions. I mean, the WBBL final had more spectators this year than the BBL final had. Like, there was that piece of research that came out yesterday about how many viewers there were of the women's 100, and I think it was I think maybe 25% of them didn't watch any men's cricket that year, that watched some of the women's 100, and that's a massive show of faith and a demonstration of marketability. And women's IPL would be that and tenfold more. Like, it's a proposition that makes business sense, as well as being just the right thing to do to advance women's cricket in the country.
Yeah, I was just looking that up actually when you were coming to that point. And so this is a Guardian story from earlier in the week. Of the 4.9 million new viewers of the 100, 71% had gone on to watch other women's sport, with tennis and football the biggest beneficiaries. Meanwhile, as Ben says, 25% of those who watched the women's 100 or England women's cricket did not watch any men's cricket in 2021. So this is a product, such a crap word as well, forget it. This is a great thing that sits alone, sits distinct from the rest of it as an attractive, seductive piece of sporting theatre on its own terms. And look, at the risk of coming back to the Harrison thing, for all that his legacy is pockmarked, this is one area where the ECB do deserve not to be chucked in the stocks. They have helped create something that is hopefully lasting and significant.
I guess, although even there,
I shouldn't have gone down that road.
One of the big successes of the 100 last year was the double headers, which came about essentially by accident because of COVID and sort of wanting to save on a few sort of managing costs.
Oh, yeah, sure.
And also this year, I don't think enough criticism has been made of the decision to cut the women's 100 because of the Commonwealth Games. I mean, sure, that makes a slight scheduling snafu, but it's like, considering the amount of cricket they get the men to play, like, all day, every day, the fact that, like, the idea they couldn't have squeezed in 8 more women's games at some point over the 3 weeks after the Commonwealth Games, or like, just that there would have been a way around that if the will and the desire had been there, and it kind of seems like it just wasn't.
Fair point.
Moving on, India are the under-19 World Cup winners for the 5th time in their history after beating England by 4 wickets in the final. No other team has won the competition more than 3 times. I watched the whole thing. To be honest, it's quite a frustrating watch. England were always up against it after losing a couple of early wickets before Somerset's James Rowe, who's I think second cousins with Dan Lawrence, scored 95 to give England a chance.
Get him in.
He wears number 55 on his back, as does Ben Stokes. And for a while, it looked like another left-handed number 55 would save England a World Cup final, but it wasn't to be. Raj Bauer, a seam bowling all-rounder, took a fiver for India. But I think the person who impressed me most was India's left-arm opener, Ravi Kumar, who got rid of Jacob Bethel, swung it both ways, basically, away in LBW. And that was pretty much the game there.
Yeah, it was a shame, wasn't it? You thought if England were going to have a chance, it needed something special from Bethel, who's obviously the gun player in that side. So when he went early, it was just a bit like, yeah. I mean, obviously India at under 19 level are probably even stronger than they are at senior level.
Yeah, and I guess like England, they were kind of in it when they were defending their total. It was like 190 odd, but they just weren't really attacking enough. There was a long period of time where the spinners were on really well, but it wasn't a slip in. And a couple of times, ball went through the slip area, and obviously didn't get any wickets. And VVS Laxman, who's I think heads the Indian academy, he's not the under 19 coach, but he heads kind of the national youth setup. He gave a lot of credit to the selectors because there's been very little cricket played by these guys before the tournament. So normally under 19 players would have played a fair bit of Ranji Trophy before they play for the under 19s, but I think only one or two of them have played any first team cricket in India. So they've actually done quite well to pick the 15 best players, which I guess is quite interesting. Joe, what's your moment of the week?
Yeah, it just came out of that under 19 World Cup. Really interesting story, developing story, which I first saw reported on ESPN Cricket Info by Nagraj Golapudi. So Afghanistan returning home from the under 19 World Cup had a stopover at London Heathrow, and four members of their tour party, which is one player and three board members, all of which are yet to be named, didn't get on the second leg of that flight. Cricket Info reported that it appeared they were going to seek asylum in the UK, with the Taliban obviously having seized power in Afghanistan last year, and lots of people leaving the country for fear of their lives. And the Afghanistan Cricket Board have subsequently confirmed that was the case, that they are seeking asylum. Afghanistan's head coach, Rais Ahmadzai, had said he'd messaged the quartet telling them to return, saying he felt they would feel forever guilty if they don't. Interestingly, this has happened previously in 2009, after the Under-19 World Cup qualifiers in Toronto. Two Afghan players, a few Afghan players stayed behind. Two actually went on to represent Canada. But on this one, it throws up loads of very interesting questions. Obviously, Afghan cricketers travel the world now, playing in franchises around the world. Will other players opt to do the same in future? Is this a route out of a country which is obviously in huge crisis under a terrible regime? Is this something that might appeal to other players in future? If so, what will the Taliban do about it? Does this potentially have an impact on Afghanistan tours in future? Will they try and prevent them? Or do they not care? They're not big fans of cricket. They've obviously got rid of the women's side already. And then I guess most immediately, what are the UK government going to do about this quartet? These four people are seeking asylum. UK government have sent people home to Afghanistan and Yemen in recent months, despite Foreign Office advice being that you shouldn't do that. They've just gone and done it anyway. You'd think with a relatively high profile case like this, the quartet would probably be allowed to stay, but we'll have to see. I just think it's a fascinating story with lots of different strands to it, and it'll be really interesting to see how it kind of develops over the next couple of weeks.
And a timely reminder that although we see Afghanistan players play all over the world and their national team playing World Cups, it is still pretty grim back home.
Absolutely, yeah.
As we mentioned a couple of times in the show already, Justin Langer has ended 6 months of speculation over his role with the Australian men's cricket team by resigning as head coach. Ricky Ponting has labelled the treatment of his ex-teammate as embarrassing. Long story short, Langer was offered a six-month contract extension, which he rejected. His last two acts as head coach were to win the T20 World Cup and beat England 4-0 in the Ashes. Ponting said, "It's been a really poor 6 months with the way Cricket Australia have handled some of the better people in Australian cricket, those being Justin Langer and Tim Payne. I think it's been almost embarrassing the way they handled those two cases." Today, Pat Cummins released a statement paying respect to Langer, but also kind of explaining why the players had voiced their concerns about Langer staying on, saying that it wasn't the intensity, that wasn't the issue, but rather the players, in order to get better, needed a new style of coaching. And that was the feedback given to Cricket Australia. There's a nice line at the end about former players who've been giving Cummings a bit of stick recently. To all past players, I want to say this. Just as you have always stuck up for your mates, I'm sticking up for mine.
That is a line that bears repeating. An extraordinary kind of sign-off, flourish, really, by a bloke who we kind of wondered what sort of leader he would be, if indeed he is a real leader, or if he's just a kind of stopgap, you know, like front man, if you like. But yeah, no, I mean,
he's growing into it, isn't he?
My God, has he?
Saving the planet and getting Justin Langer sacked
all in a week.
Yeah, I mean,
all in a week.
Objectively, quite a strange sequence of events. Like, there was more energy among the Australian camp to get rid of their coach than England to get rid of theirs off the Ashes.
Yeah, indeed. It's upheaval on both sides, really. But that line from Cummins, that has just put a big full stop, hasn't it? An underline there just saying, look, this is done now, folks. This is my team. This is where I'm going from here on in. Thank you, JL. Great man, legend of the game. But, you know, this is my lot now.
Is there a part of you that thinks that players shouldn't really be able to do this, being like, we've just won two massive tournaments and now we want a new style of coaching?
I think if you look at cricket historically, then yeah, it begins and finishes with a captain of a side, and a coach is an addendum to that captain. Obviously the power balance has changed in over the years, but if you are a captain, if you are running that thing, the buck stops with you entirely. You are still the boss, ultimately. No one's going to go round and say Heather Knight, you know, you're not the boss, or Joe Root, you're not the boss. And the same has to apply now with a new captain coming into Australian cricket. And if you look as well through the lineage of Australian captains, you imagine Ian Chappell bowing down to a coach, or Greg Chappell, or Ponting himself. Who had John Buchanan kind of, you know, with the bibs and the cones in, very much in the background. So it surprises me for the frankness and the bluntness and the kind of the showy element to it as well. I mean, just run it by again. Just as you've always stuck up for your mates, I'm sticking up for mine. You know, that is a powerful piece of work right there. And I admire it. I kind of wish that our skipper, 3 or 4 years into the job, would be slightly more demonstrable as well, you know?
The fascinating thing for me is Cricket Australia's role in this. I don't find it that surprising that Cummins and the Australian players might want to get rid of Justin Langer, having watched that documentary. The interesting thing is that the board have allowed it to happen. Now, cricket boards around the world can talk about spreading the game, diversity, inclusion, all the words that Tom Harrison says ad nauseum, but bottom line is they want to win stuff. They want to win games. That basically takes the pressure off you. The other things, while they might still exist in the backgrounds, aren't amplified in the same way. So Australia have done exactly what they wanted to do. They've won a World Cup and the Ashes. And Cricket Australia have still said, all right, Pat, we'll get rid of the coach for you. Which, you know, Cummins wasn't going to stand down as Australia captain if Langer was allowed to stay on. They offered him a 6-month contract. It wasn't like it was so toxic they had to get rid of him. And yet they've still kind of rolled over and said yes, which, you know, in the long run might be the right decision. Maybe it's a story of player power, really. It's a story of modern player power and the authority that players now wield. And see, captains, particularly in Australia, have always had such a kind of an awe around them. But this is obviously like a squad decision. I think that's quite interesting in itself.
Well, I guess the thing is, like, you need to have a functioning coach player relationship, and coaches are replaceable and players aren't, really. You know, you can't replace Pat Cummins. There are like enough
high level coaches.
Would you say
it is functioning?
Well, I mean if, according to the players, it's not functioning as well as it could be, I guess. And I guess the other thing is, if you take Langer's regime as a whole across the 4 years, I don't think the results have been that good or even good, really.
We had a question on this, and I'll get you to answer it. Johnny asks, is Justin Langer a phenomenal coach who led Australia to a T20 title against all odds, thrashed England in Australia, and was the first coach not to lose the Ashes in England since 2001, all while bringing through the next generation of talent in Labuschagne, Head and Green, or B, an extremely lucky coach who had an all-time great bowling attack and two generational batsmen who threw away an Ashes series win in England, saw Australia's white ball game drop off, overseeing a lost series against a second-string India side, Got lucky at the T20 World Cup and came up against a historically bad England in the last Ashes, all while being so difficult to get on with, the players wanted to get rid of him even after winning the Ashes and the World Cup. No nuance, please. This is sport, so it can only be one of those extremes. Ben, which is it, A or B?
Yeah, well,
that's a great question.
Closer to the last than the former, definitely. I mean, if you're picking out successes of the Langer regime, I guess you'd go to the 2019 Ashes and you'd go to the T20 World Cup. There are elements of fortune and circumstance in both. I mean, that 2019 Ashes, they didn't win it. It was a 2-2 draw, and they haven't won an away series since, 2016, I think. Part of that's not Langer's fault. And what's weird as well is that he's had this long reign as coach, but Australia haven't even played that much cricket. I think I worked out that Pope has played in more tests than Langer has coached in, which seems weird because we think of Pope as kind of still a slight babe of the England Test team.
I can make any point about what's happened in Test cricket by how many Test matches Ollie Pope has played.
Yeah, yeah. But they had that Ashes win and the T20 World Cup win. But again, you know, they won all their tosses, and it's a format where you do get sort of freak results and things can kind of happen and fortune can play its part. And the
so
loss,
B.
What'd you say?
You're saying B.
Yeah, and well, that loss to India last year, that should really have been, like, in my opinion, 10-year ending for both Tim Payne and Justin Langer. I mean, that it's an Australia team.
They had a chance, didn't they? You're right. They had a chance a year ago to stage manage it respectfully so everyone could break with a degree of dignity, as it looks like they've allowed that kind of toxicity to fester a little bit, and now it's exploded.
Well, they weren't expecting
on the back of a 4-0 Ashes.
Well, they weren't expecting to win the T20 World Cup, were they? I think this has created an issue. The Ashes was like a given, really. The T20 World Cup complicated matters because it's like, well, God, now he's basically done the double.
But if you look at how good the Australia team should be on paper, like they have arguably, well, six Australia greats. One who is well on his way to becoming one, and two all-time greats in their team. And it's not as if the supporting cast are that bad either, in like Head, Khawaja, Green, and a keeper who's always like been capable. That's a team that should be smashing everyone at home and competing pretty decently and winning series away. They have like been fallible at home and haven't won away for absolutely ages. So that's not a particularly glittering test record, I think.
In fairness, they've not really played that much away from home under Langer. Yeah, but yeah.
And we were mentioned in his resignation speech, and yet there still wasn't enough to overturn
yeah.
Cricket Australia's decision.
Did Pat Cummins know that Wisden made him coach of the year, though? Maybe that might have swung it.
Well, it was top of the ABC News, no?
not only were Pat Cummins and co allegedly taking action against their head coach, but they've also been taking action against the ever-looming climate crisis, setting up the initiative Cricket for Climate. I talked to Tanya Aldridge about the initiative and cricket's relationship with climate change. Last week, Pat Cummins, writing in The Guardian, announced that he, alongside a long list of big names from Australian cricket, are setting up a new initiative, Cricket for Climate, that aims to take cricket in Australia down to net zero. Tanya, great to have you on the show. We've not really talked about the climate emergency before and how it affects cricket specifically on the podcast. This isn't something that's theoretical, right? Or in the distant future, we've seen extreme weather events impacting cricket already. And is it right to say that some cricket-playing nations are particularly vulnerable to climate change?
Yeah, that's right. I mean, I think that's one of the... I mean, obviously, cricket is vulnerable because we're all vulnerable, right? But one of the reasons it's particularly vulnerable is just where it's played. You could pull out a million different statistics, but of the 10 countries at the highest risk of multiple climate hazards, you know, three of them are Bangladesh, India and Pakistan, and those kind of statistics just repeat themselves, and cities that have got very high pollution levels like Delhi, Lahore, Karachi, Dhaka, and then you've got water shortages in various places of the world. Obviously, there was the day zero situation in South Africa a few years ago when they actually thought they were going to run out of water in Cape Town, and there will be water shortages in Pakistan. Yeah, basically, you can kind of go down through the cricket playing countries, and even places like the UK, which you'd think would be a fairly resilient compared to other countries. You know, we've had flooding. I think it was £3.5 million worth of flooding during the high winds a few years ago. So it is very vulnerable.
So what was your initial reaction to seeing that story from Cummins, and yeah, kind of a who's who of big names currently playing cricket in both the men's and women's game in Australia?
Yeah, I thought it was fantastic, actually. I think these conversations have been happening in kind of little pockets. I know that the England women's team have talked about this, and they've had the ECB's sustainability manager to talk to them, and some of them have changed their diets, and then there's Joe Cook over at Glamorgan, who I know has done, I think he's spoken to the PCA and he's very involved and has been working with Glamorgan on their kind of sustainability program, I suppose. But yes, to see Pat Cummins and all those other big names, like you say, it's kind of like a who's who of Australian greats really at the moment. I think sports people worry when they speak out about things like climate, because people can always call them hypocrites and say, it's all right for you, you know, you're jetting around the world 12 times a year, you know, and here you are lecturing us not to eat so much chicken or whatever. So I think it is quite a brave thing to do. But I know that he, Cummins, signed a letter written by David Pocock, the Wallabies, ex-Wallabies player, sort of last year or a couple of years ago. So I think it's been on his mind for a while.
So yeah, kind of as you say, a lot of people's reaction to what Cummins has said will be that, hang on, cricketers fly all over the place and flying is really bad for the environment. And whilst eating meat is not great for the environment, flying is worse. What is your reaction to people who say, but hang on, they fly all over the world, etc., and flying is really bad?
To go back to what you said before, I think what they were very keen on is that they were wanted to do stuff rather than just say stuff. I think I'm right in saying this, that they are putting their hands in their own pockets. And what they want to do is install solar. Well, their kind of first thing is they want to install solar panels on local cricket clubs throughout Australia. You know, Australia is just perfect for solar panels. You've got free energy, basically. So I think that's what they wanted to start by doing. It's the charges of hypocrisy. I suppose we're all hypocrites, aren't we? Unless we're kind of living in a cave with no possessions, we're all hypocrites one way or other, depending on, you know, maybe we've had, you've got a big car, or you've had three children who eat loads of meat or whatever it is. So I suppose they are trying to reduce their own footprint whilst being professional cricketers. So unless, if you say that you can only start taking climate action when you're perfect, then no one's going to do anything. So I think by looking at your own carbon footprint in your own situation, I think that's a brilliant thing to do. I think it's going to be complicated for them, because as soon as you if you reduce your footprint as much as you can, then you get to offsetting, and offsetting is obviously a more controversial topic. There's lots of kind of debate as to whether offsetting is good and various offsetting schemes. Hope that makes sense.
Definitely. And then are there similar initiatives out there from either groups of players or boards, or is this the first of its kind in a way?
I think this is the first high profile one. Like I say, I think England women are kind of on the brink of doing something, and I know that they were talking about trying to offset, to get back to that again, their flights and stuff when they went over to Australia. There are individual stadiums have taken action, you know, the Oval, Lords, Edgbaston, Glamorgan. But I think those would be the sort of main four. Gloucestershire have done a lot of good work. They've actually signed up to the UN's climate action framework. So I think it has been, a lot of it has been facilities based rather than player based. I don't know if you guys covered it, but there was a report that came out about a couple of weeks ago about more about kit and how you could try and make cricket kit and cricket gear more sustainable, and talking about the circular economy and making kit out of different material, kind of bamboo. And we had the thing about the bamboo bats. I don't remember if that was last year. So I thought there are kind of little pockets of conversations. And I think the ECB and Cricket Australia are also kind of quite far down the path of having a sustainability strategy, but there isn't anything that's been led from a centre, if you know what I mean.
And finally, just if people are listening to this and wondering how they can improve and do more for the environment, what can just the casual cricket fan do more, or maybe someone who's involved with their club, for instance, what can they do more?
Well, I suppose on a personal level, you know, it's the things like drive less, take more public transport, eat less meat. If you're in a cricket club, and lots of people do this already, so the car share, I know that didn't happen so much during COVID. Use less disposable stuff. If you're restocking a bar, I guess have things in cans rather than in plastic bottles. The winner and runner-up of the Cricketers' Greenest Ground competition last year, it was a Manchester club called Wally Range and Atash Green that are just outside Colchester. And they'd, in their different ways, made loads of small changes that just added up to quite a lot, from things like putting solar panels on, to trying to make their actual cricket grounds attractive to different creatures, you know, increasing the biodiversity in their cricket grounds. Again, sort of stocking the bar with things that are recyclable. But I think they've both got websites. So if any of your listeners were interested, you know, just take a look, because there's some really good, really good ideas there.
Awesome. Thanks a lot for your time, Tanya.
Pleasure.
Some international news to cover. We'll start with Australia. Australia will be touring Pakistan for the first time in 24 years very soon. They've announced a full strength squad for that series. I guess the biggest headlines are there's no Glenn Maxwell, and Marcus Harris is still in the squad. Scott Boland's still there, so watch out, Pakistan. New Zealand have announced a squad for their two test series against South Africa. Should be a good series. That New Zealand squad, Joe, just isn't quite as strong as what we've been used to recently. From the side that won the World Test Championship final, there's no Watling and Taylor. They're both retired. Williamson's injured. Bolt's missing at least the first test of the series, and there's still no Ajaz Patel.
Yeah, well, we kind of talked about this a month or so back, that this could be quite a tricky period for New Zealand cricket after the kind of glory of last year in the World Test Championship win. They've lost quite a few players, and they don't have that pool of players to fall back on. You take Williamson out of any side in the world, and it's going to leave a massive hole. With New Zealand, it's a gaping hole. And I don't know. I think I know New Zealand's record at home is phenomenal, but I quite fancy South Africa to take that series. It should be a really good contest. With that and Australia-Pakistan, we've got two really good test series coming up. Mm.
And England-West Indies as well.
Sure.
India are 1-0 up against West Indies in a three-match ODI series. In the second ODI, India 235 for 9 at the time of recording. Anything interesting in the first game?
No. Kohli played a weirdly frantic 4-ball 8, and Rohit Sharma captained quite well. Jason Holder made a nice 50-odd. Rohit made a very attractive 60-odd.
Elsewhere, South Africa came from 1-0 down to beat West Indies 2-1 in a women's ODI series in South Africa. Laura Wolfart became the sixth woman to score 3 ODI 100s before turning 23 in the third ODI. And Shabnim Ismail took 8 wickets in those last 2 wins for South Africa. Ben, there are millions of England players playing in the PSL. Do you want to pick out 3 who've done particularly well since the last pod?
Yeah, well, the standout is Jason Roy, who made one of the great T20 hundreds, really smashing Rashid Khan and Shaheen Shah Afridi when they were chasing. I think Keta Gladiator, who played for it, ever chased as many. And he comes at his first game since quarantining after arriving from the West Indies and just takes them apart. In a way, actually, you see Roy take apart attacks, but you often see him do it quickly, and that's what makes him so valuable to me. He does it quickly at the start and then gets out before he slows down. What was interesting in this game is actually he really took responsibility in a way he sort of showed a few signs of doing in that West Indies series as well, in that he got off to an incredible start. I think he brought up his 50 before the end of the fourth over, which is obviously freakish. But then actually he sort of scored about like 35 or 36 or 28-ish through the middle, and then got a couple of sixes to get to his 100, and then pushed on again. And sort of that little anchoring role through the middle is something you don't actually see of Roy too much, which was kind of refreshing. But also the ball strike was absolutely brilliant. His first scoring shot was off the second ball he faced off Shaheen, was this kind of checked straight punch drive, which just flew miles way further than had any right to over long off. Alex Hales has been really good, as he often is in these franchise leagues. He also won himself a few fans in Pakistan by criticising the ECB for pulling out of the tour last year, which is a kind of, I'm sure Alex Hales would have gone on the tour if they'd asked him. he's made a brilliant partnership with Paul Sterling, who is probably an outside shot for a bid at this IPL auction, maybe not even outside, a decent shot, considering his stock continues to rise, and he would be a good value pick because teams have not picked him in the past, I suppose. And David Willey's just been really good again as well. Harry Brooks has played a couple of games, but David Willey, he's the one English player who plays for Moulton Sultans, who are 5 from 5 at the moment.
Great name.
And he's just taken the new ball, done pretty well, kept the run rate down. They're so good, actually, that they have been able to leave him out on occasion. But he's been his excellent new ball self, I suppose.
And I guess just on Harry Brook, he's after a really bad BBL, an England debut where it didn't go great for him. He's doing really well in the middle order, where it's obviously a role where there aren't that many English players who are standout candidates for that role in the future. You're on a roll, Ben. Do you want to just take us through the BPL as well, the Bangladesh Premier League?
Well, that's also your areas, I think. But it's been weird, basically. So what's happened? So the funniest one is that Mohammad Shahzad, the sort of lovable Afghanistan wicket batter, he copped a sanction for vaping on the field of play. I think there was like a rain delay going on, and he was out there in his tracksuit.
Is that what it was?
Oh, sorry, he wasn't.
You told me this yesterday. I thought he was fielding at mid wicket. Just having a cheeky gasp.
Or keeping.
He's a keeper. You can't vape with your keeping gloves on. Maybe he can, but so that was quite fun.
If anyone can, definitely.
There was quite a strange instance with Ravi Bapara, Phil. If we're getting through lots of pod favourites, he was named captain sort of right before the toss. In fact, the team sheet that had been sent to the media had the previous captain's name on the sheet. And then in the game that he was captaining, he got handed a 5-run penalty for ball tampering. So that's quite a punchy way to start your first.
No, not Ravi.
He's been handed a few demerit points and a hefty fine.
I find that impossible to believe.
Okay. And also, Chris Gayle made a very, very slow 50 batting through the innings. He batted through the innings for 51 not out, which is not something you see Chris Gayle do very often. So it's been quite a strange tournament, but an enjoyable one from the bits I've seen here and there.
A couple of reader questions and messages to finish off the show. Duncan asks, interesting points and everything, but are we really going to avoid the most pressing issue of the day and neglect to ask Taha where his shirt was from on last week's episode? I've checked with Taha. It's from Zara, if you're wondering. That's one for our YouTube audience. Nick asks, I've been reading Alistair Cook's autobiography recently and have been thinking about the skill of opening the batting. So wanted to ask whether you guys thought if this is the toughest job in sport. Personally, I think it is because of the mental pressure it brings. Anyone want to answer that? Toughest job in sport?
Yeah, it's a really good question. Being a leggy in Test cricket, obviously T20 is easy these days for a leggy, but I think that's quite a tough one. Mm. I mean, there aren't any to start with.
Well, it seems like it's quite easy to me in a way. I mean,
opening?
Well, yeah, you get out there, you face like an over, you get out and you go and put your feet up for 2 days, right?
That's not what you're supposed to do.
No, I know, but I mean, you can, if it goes badly, the worse you do, the easier a life you have as long as you sort of stay in the team.
Yeah, you haven't played much cricket, have you?
What about the mental anguish?
Yeah, sure, there's mental anguish all
you
over
don't
the
really
place,
get that though, do you? Indestructible.
Can we not think of any from any other sports? Or is cricket the hardest sport?
Ultra marathon running seems pretty hard.
Harder, yeah.
Triathloning.
Steeplechase always looks a bit unfair when you're really knackered and you have to jump that really high thing and then fall into some water.
Also,
tennis seems pretty hard. Obviously there was that there was that Australian Open final the other week that went on for five and a half hours. And yet they were still at such a high level. I was trying to work out how long would Rafael Nadal have to play tennis for before I could even like win a point off him. And it would be so, so long, like 12 hours. He would have to be like literally falling asleep, standing up before I could send a ball that was even vaguely troubling him to get back. So it's a slightly different question, but in terms of gap between the best and the rest, that's
it is a different question. I think on the Winter Olympic theme, the ski jump, I just don't really get what the intermediate point is between being a beginner and being an expert, because you know that there's a lot that can go wrong, I guess, when you similar to the pole vault. I've always wondered, how do you get into the pole vault?
I guess you start with a small pole
one, yeah, I
and
guess
then it gets gradually bigger.
I guess with a ski jump you start with a small jump and it gets
hold on, does the pole change height or do you just hold it further down the pole?
I can't and summon this.
San Marino goalkeeper.
Yes, yeah.
Or San Marino striker. Yeah. Just being a San Marino footballer.
Yeah. Again, San Marino striker, you just stand around. San Marino goalkeeper, you just pick out the net.
But it's not just like...
We need it at the end, guys. One last message, which is a really nice one, from Jimmy. He said, I've just signed up to the magazine due to this podcast. I haven't subscribed to a cricket magazine in 15 plus years. I love this podcast. Geeky and nostalgic enough. A love of the romance of the game and good common sense as well. My happy place. That's a very nice message. Oh, thank you very much.
What does it mean, geeky?
As always, you can get in touch with us either through leaving a comment on the podcast app or getting in touch with us at podcast@wisden.com. That is all for today's show. Cheers, Phil. Cheers, Joe. Cheers, Ben. This has been the Wisden Cricket Weekly Podcast. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next week. Cheers.
Podcast Network.